Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday the 20th of June, these are our main stories. Kenya's security forces clash with hundreds of protesters opposed to planned tax rises. A day after signing a defence agreement with North Korea, Russia's President Vladimir Putin visits Vietnam. More than 1,000 people are reported to have died during this year's Hajj pilgrimage as temperatures in Saudi Arabia top 50 degrees. Also in this podcast, the new treatment that leaves you more active than you were before your heart attack. And the British musician Ratman on his new Netflix show about superheroes in South London.
I just never understood someone getting superpowers and the first thing they do is get a cape, spandex and stop a bridge from falling down. So I figured, if I got powers, that wouldn't be my first move. So let's start there.
We begin this podcast on the streets of the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Tear gas canisters exploding as protesters chant, "We are peaceful," expressing their opposition to government plans to raise more than $2.5 billion in new taxes. The demonstrators, many of them young and armed only with their smartphones, were confronted by riot police, some on horseback and water cannon. This was the view of one of them.
How do you even tax a cancer patient? Are you inhuman that much? How do you tax a girl from the rural areas who cannot afford a pad worth 119? That's too much.
For the latest on the situation, I've been speaking to our Deputy Africa Editor, Anne Soy, who's in Nairobi.
The young people have come with their own strategy with the protests. We're used to protests following one street. They're in all streets trying to get to Parliament, which has been cordoned off as MPs continue with the debate on their controversial finance bill. They've just been behind me. They have now been pushed back. There are two water cannons behind me. You can hear the tear gas canisters going off in another direction. So it's quite dramatic out here today. And it is not just Nairobi. These protests began in Nairobi on Tuesday and have now spread across the country to various towns, including the president's own hometown of Eldoret in Western Kenya.
Now, we just heard from one protester there that what they're saying is it's a perfectly legitimate thing to protest about.
They're protesting the increase or the introduction of taxes on goods that they consider basic commodities like sanitary towels and diapers. On Tuesday, the government gave some concessions, including scrapping a 16% value-added tax that they had imposed on bread. They scrapped motor vehicle tax as well. But then the protesters are saying they have not gone far enough. The government, on the other hand, is saying that they have to raise revenue somehow. The economy is under pressure because of a huge debt burden. More than 60% of the government's revenue goes to repaying loans, and therefore they have to look for ways to raise more money from people. But the Gen Zs are out here saying that they've had enough. The cost of living is too high. They're suffocating under it.
Obviously, the protest is noisy and there are a lot of people there. Is it your sense that you need to respond to this kind of thing with riot police, police on horseback, canisters of tear gas, that kind of thing?
Traditionally, how Kenyan police have dealt with protests, which is why you're hearing the chant there in that clip that you played, with the Gen Z saying, "No, we are peaceful. We don't come with stones. We're not hurling stones. We're not looting. And if anyone attempts to do that, we are going to arrest them ourselves." So they're trying to do it differently, but they're meeting a force that is traditionally used to using excessive force to crush protests.
And it doesn't feel, just from listening to what's going on around you and hearing your description, Anne, like this is going to be brought to an end anytime soon.
No, it doesn't look like that. And, you know, they're resolute. I have watched them being sprayed with that itchy liquid from water cannons several times. They disperse, and within minutes they're back. You know, they have overwhelmed police in some instances, but the police are trying to keep them away from Parliament.
That was our Deputy Africa Editor Anne Soy amid those noisy protests in Nairobi. Next to Vietnam, the latest country to roll out the red carpet for the Russian President Vladimir Putin. Military Military bands played the Russian national anthem as Mr. Putin shook hands with dignitaries at a ceremony in the capital, Hanoi. This one day after signing that mutual defence pact with North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un. Our Southeast Asia correspondent, Jonathan Head, has been monitoring Mr. Putin's tour of the region.
Of course, Vietnam, in some ways, is a much bigger prize for him than North Korea. North Korea is a fellow pariah state. No one's too surprised that those two countries should be thrown together. But as you would have seen from the American reaction, they're very displeased that their new friend Vietnam that they've been wooing is rolling out the red carpet for Mr. Putin and giving him all the kind of pomp and sort of welcome that President Biden got last year on his groundbreaking visit to Vietnam. But that is the nature of Vietnam's foreign policy, which is strictly nonpartisan, neutral. They like to be friends with all, enemies of none. And remember the very strong historical ties between the two countries. Whatever Vietnam thinks of Mr. Putin, Vietnam has a very strong sense of historical obligation to Russia and the former Soviet Union for all the help it gave Vietnam in those long years that it was fighting the French and the Americans, and even after that. Those things will not be forgotten, and Vietnam has ignored the American process and is giving Mr. Putin, I think, a welcome he will really appreciate. You know, this, he's on a bid to make himself look as though he is not without friends, and Vietnam is certainly giving the impression that he's a very old friend.
Neutrality on the war in Ukraine is clearly a pretty big prize for Russia. What's Vietnam going to get out of this? They're having talks about trade and military equipment and energy and all those things. What does Vietnam want out of this?
Look, there isn't very much of substance. It wants things that it already has with Russia to continue. That is, reliable supplies of military equipment. Vietnam's armed forces are almost entirely supplied by Russian equipment. That's a worry because they've been worrying about it for some time. And obviously, the Ukraine war has made it even more worrying about how long they can depend on that. And they are looking for alternatives. They also want continued Russian engagement in oil and gas exploration in the South China Sea, a tricky issue because those are areas contested with China. And China, of course, has a lot of leverage over Russia. But these aren't essential things for Vietnam. They're important to it. What really matters to Vietnam is that it is seen to be positioning itself equidistantly from all the big powers it has to deal with. I'm not sure that Vietnam was entirely happy about President Putin coming right on the backs of going to see Kim Jong-un in North Korea, but they were not going to neglect him when he wanted to come. They were going to make it clear they won't be told by anybody who their friends are. That's the nature of Vietnam's foreign policy, and they're going to stick to that.
Comes with risks, though. I was just going to say, putting yourself on a list with North Korea and not that many other countries, it carries its own diplomatic risks.
It does have risks, and they're aware of that. You know, we'll have to see how long Vietnam can keep up this balancing act. But, you know, whatever the Americans say, at the moment, America perhaps needs Vietnam more than Vietnam needs the US. Vietnam does need the markets in the US. It does not want to give up on those. You know, I think whatever the risks are, Vietnam has shown it can pull off this balancing act up to now. The world's a tricky place now and things could change.
Our Southeast Asia correspondent, Jonathan Head, with me. A landmark legal judgment from the Supreme Court in the UK could stop future fossil fuel projects from going ahead. It's ruled that a local council in Southeast England should have considered the climate impacts of burning the oil extracted from a well when it gave the initial planning permission. The story from our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt.
This judgment, by a 3-2 majority, is likely to have a significant impact on future fossil fuel projects in the UK. It means, as well as considering the immediate impact of a new fossil fuel development, local authorities will now have to consider the downstream emissions as well, all the carbon dioxide the fuel will produce when it is burnt. Campaigners claim the judgment could block new fossil fuel projects, including the massive Rosebank oil field off the Shetland Islands and the proposed coal mine in Whitehaven in Cumbria too. Today's judgment relates to the Horsehill oil well in Surrey. The 3.3 million tonnes of crude oil it was predicted to produce over the next 20 years would have created over 10 million tonnes of CO2, according to Friends of the Earth. By the standards of international fossil fuel developments, that is tiny. But the repercussions of today's ruling could reshape the UK's energy future.
Now, let's talk about the extreme hot weather in different parts of the world at the moment. You may have heard in our earlier Global News podcast about hundreds of people reported to have died during this year's Hajj pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia, temperatures in Mecca exceeding 50 degrees. Many countries have now confirmed the deaths of their citizens. The Indonesian authorities say nearly 200 of their nationals died. Unconfirmed reports suggest total deaths may exceed 900, but Saudi Arabia hasn't given official figures. This pilgrim from Nigeria, Aisha Idris, says she was lucky to survive.
The soul was really on us, because even me, is by the mercy of God that I survived it. Your throat will be dry, so I have to be hydrating myself with water and be pouring water on my head. That is what made me survive, because at a point, as if I'm going to faint, somebody has to assist me with umbrella, because I don't know that the heat will reach that level.
A severe, unrelenting heat wave continues across India. Since March, the country's recorded more than 100 temperature-related deaths and 40,000 suspected cases of heat stroke. Our South Asia correspondent in Delhi, Samira Hussain, has been telling me more.
There has been a heat wave in India, in parts of the country, for several weeks now. In fact, you know, it's probably one of the longest heat waves that we have seen. And North India, where I am right now in the capital of New Delhi, on average, the temperatures are 6 to 8 degrees hotter than they normally are for the month of June. And you have other parts of the country, even in North India, where the temperatures have hit over 50 degrees Celsius. So these are really extremely hot temperatures, and making it really quite deadly for people is that, you know, there's large parts of the country that, you know, depend on migrant labor, or that, you know, people have to work outside in this kind of heat. Or you have the elderly that are much more susceptible to these temperatures. And that's how you have these really severe instances of heat stroke. And there have been quite a few deaths around the country just in this last week. But if you take into consideration how long this heat wave has been going, there's been several hundred documented deaths because of the heat. But then remember, there's so many more that go unreported.
And another aspect we've talked about on the programme already is that schools have been closed because it's not been deemed to be safe for children to be confined in classrooms, and therefore children have been at home.
That's right, because remember, many schools don't have any air conditioning, and schools don't also have enough fans or enough electricity. And so it's more dangerous for students to be inside these classrooms that can get extremely hot. So better that students are at home. But you can see that, you know, that's just one impact of these kinds of extreme temperatures that have just on students. And then, of course, there are those that are forced to work outside. The impact is even greater.
We're seeing extreme heat in many parts of the world. We've had people losing their lives on Greek islands. We've had people losing their lives in the Middle East during their Hajj pilgrimage in Mecca. How does the situation in India compare to what would normally happen at this time of year, when it would normally be hot?
It would normally be hot, but you wouldn't see these kinds of prolonged extreme temperatures. In fact, I was at a local government hospital just yesterday, and the head of the hospital was saying to us that, look, you know, just in this month of June, we've seen 45 heat-related patients come into this hospital. There's been a dramatic increase just in the last few days, and they have seen just in the last 2 days at least five people have died because of heat-related injuries. Now, remember, that's just one government hospital in central Delhi, and this is a scene that's being repeated absolutely everywhere. So it's really very dangerous.
Our correspondent Samira Hussain with me from Delhi. Can patients recovering from a heart attack go on to have a more active life than they did before? New research in Austria suggests so. Specialists say gentle shock waves can regenerate heart tissue. This study found those who were given the treatment were able to walk longer distances a year later, and their hearts were able to pump more blood. Here's our health correspondent, Jim Reid.
58-year-old Josef is being wheeled off to theatre for a heart bypass operation. Like millions around the world, he lives with heart disease, and last year it all came to a head.
I felt a stab of pain that moved into my left hand. Then I was short of breath. I had this kind of fear of death, Well, you don't know what to do next and what's going to happen.
But today, Josef will have some unusual treatment as part of his surgery. The doctors at this Austrian hospital will apply mild shockwaves to his damaged heart to help it regenerate. This handheld machine is designed to deliver sound waves, setting off a chain reaction inside the tissue and stimulating the growth of new blood vessels. Johannes Hohlfeld is the surgeon about to perform this new treatment.
Okay, so what I do now is take the heart, the beating heart, and we can now start, please. This is a patient with a severely reduced heart function due to chronically undersupplied heart muscle. And with shockwave therapy, we can induce the formation of new blood vessels, and thereby the heart muscle gets strengthened.
In a trial of 63 patients, those who had the new therapy were able to recover more quickly and their hearts pumped more blood.
They can walk much, much longer than they did before treatment. And this for patients means that they are able again to go out for a walk with their dog or to go to the supermarket, care for their everyday life. This really makes a difference for their quality of life.
Marcus had bypass surgery after his heart attack and took part in the clinical trials.
Today, I actually don't have any breathing restrictions anymore. I can do sports, I can go hiking, I can go into the mountains, and the condition for me is the way it was before the heart attack.
Shockwaves are already used in other parts of medicine, such as healing skin wounds. The team in Austria plan to carry out more trials and offer their device to hospitals across Europe next year.
Our health correspondent, Jim Reid, reporting. Coming up on the Global News podcast, we'll hear the fears of a Sudanese woman whose parents are trapped in the besieged city of El Fasher.
They start listing the relatives or the people that we know who died and the injured, what house have been destroyed and what happened. And, you know, like, and then you hear this, like, bombing and the sounds of the bullets. But they say we are fine and everything.
I'm Cressy Twigg from the Global Jigsaw podcast, where we are asking, is the Islamic State group a threat once more? 10 years since they declared the establishment of a caliphate, the jihadists are claiming to be behind a spate of recent terror attacks.
You cannot ignore the danger of IS. When you're not looking, they will rebound and regroup.
The Global Jigsaw from BBC Monitoring looks at the world through the lens of its media. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
More than 35 people have died and many more are in hospital in southern India after they consumed illegally brewed liquor. Police have arrested a man for selling illicit liquor and also seized a methanol-mixed alcoholic drink. This from our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Ethirajan.
Those who drank the toxic liquor suffered from vomiting, stomachache and diarrhea. More than 100 people have been admitted to hospitals in the southern Indian state of Tamil Nadu. The condition of some of those in hospital is said to be critical. 10 police officers have been suspended over the incident. Writing on social media, the Chief Minister of Tamil Nadu, M.K. Stalin, said he was shocked and saddened by the news. Though drinking is legal in many Indian states, moonshine alcohol is popular as it is cheaper than legally made liquor.
Next, let's go to Peru. This is the sound of celebrations outside a courthouse in Lima after it jailed a group of retired soldiers for raping teenage girls in the 1980s and 90s. The 10 men carried out the abuse during the army's long-running conflict against Maoist rebels. They've been sentenced to up to 12 years in prison. Our Latin America Online editor, Vanessa Buschluter, told me more.
What they were found guilty of was not just raping those women and teenage girls, but of doing so systematically and repeatedly in order to sow terror amongst the civilian population. And this has been considered a crime against humanity. And that's why you heard those cheers there, because the human rights groups that backed this case have really found that this case is a historic one where the sexual violence committed by the security forces against the civilian population and specifically against indigenous women has been recognised.
This would be a big enough story in its own right, but the reaction comes with this hinterland of what it tells us about the history of the place.
Absolutely. Not only has it taken decades to reach this point, but also there has been very mixed feelings. We heard women cheering there because these soldiers have been sentenced, but some of the survivors have described more mixed feelings. One of them is Virginia Gonzalez.
None of those accused showed up in court. They are cowards. We have fought for 20 years. The sentence is just too short. Look at them. Some will spend no more than 8 years in jail, others six. That's too little for us.
Now, these are by no means the only abuses from that period. Are there more legal proceedings to come?
Absolutely not the only abuses committed. A Truth Commission report found that 5,000 cases of rape had been reported during those years of the armed conflict in Peru. And those are only the ones that have been reported. But these groups have a fear as well now. They obviously hope that this will set a precedent for other cases to be brought to trial. But a bill is making its way through Congress at the moment, which has been dubbed an amnesty bill, which would allow especially people from the military and the police force to evade going to trial for any alleged crimes committed before the year 2002. So many groups are very worried about this, including international courts, which have expressed their concern about this.
Vanessa Buschlusser reporting. To Sudan now, where Human Rights Watch has called for an international peacekeeping mission to protect civilians in the western region of Darfur and especially in the city of El Fasher. The paramilitary rapid support forces have been fighting the Sudanese army across the country since April last year. El Fasher is one of the flashpoints in the wider war that's created the world's worst humanitarian crisis with millions at risk of famine. 8 million people have been displaced with seemingly no prospect of a ceasefire. It's pretty hard to communicate with people in El Fasher. My colleague James Copnell has been talking to Tanzil in the Ugandan capital Kampala, who's from El Fasher and has family there. And a word of warning, you might find some of the description about what her family have been going through upsetting.
Basically, my entire family there in El Fasher, my parents and my grandmothers and my cousin who all of us grew up together, so they're still there now.
It's obviously a very terrifying situation in El Fasher right now. Are you able to communicate with them from time to time?
No, it's not easy to communicate with them, actually, because they cut all the internet connections and everything. So people now, they have to go to these Starlink spots where they can just buy Wi-Fi or buy like internet for a while, for a couple of minutes, and then... But it's not easy to reach them, actually, because it's been like maybe once a week or maybe once every time. The Wi-Fi spot is very far and it's very expensive.
And when you do manage to get a message from your parents, say, or from another family member, what sort of thing are they telling you?
They start listing the relatives or the people that we know who died in the injured. And then what house have been destroyed and what happened. And, you know, like, and then you just, you hear this, like, bombing and the sound of the bullets. But they said we are fine and everything.
So you can hear the explosions behind them when the message comes through.
Very clearly. Mm.
And I wonder what that is like for you. It must be incredibly difficult hearing those messages.
Yeah, you never know. They just tell you that we are safe. We're just taking cover or maybe laying down on the ground or something. So, but... As long as they're talking, maybe they're in a safe place. But I worry more when I don't hear from them, because you never know. So basically, since like the past maybe 3 or 4 weeks, we are all just like prepared to hear something bad. Maybe like my dad is dead. Someone is very, 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 I know is dead. And it happened. I mean, my mom lost her brother like 1 week ago, and he was dead for 2 days and nobody knew about that. Because there's no internet connection. Even his family, they don't know. And they start searching for the hospitals and everything. And then it happened that a sniper shot him with another military, like a soldier. And then the military people, they took his body and they buried him. So it was not easy to find him, basically. Nobody knew. We didn't even give him, like, this proper burial. A guy from the military told them that, yeah, we found this guy, he was dead next to one of our soldiers. So we took them and buried him because he was already dead and everything. So that's it. He just died.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah, I'm sorry for my mom.
And that was Tanzil, who was speaking to James Cotmore from Kampala. From 2025, school classrooms in the American state of Louisiana will have to display the Ten Commandments. The biblical laws must be written on a poster, which children can read easily. Louisiana is the first U.S. state to pass such a measure, which civil rights groups are expected to challenge. Here's our North America correspondent, Will Vernon.
Louisiana's controversial new law says that all state educational institutions, from nursery schools to universities, must have the Ten Commandments on display by the start of next year. The state's governor, Jeff Landry, claimed the commandments contained valuable lessons for students.
This bill mandates the display of the Ten Commandments in every classroom in public, elementary, secondary, and post-education schools in the state of Louisiana. Because if you want to respect the rule of law, you got to start from the original lawgiver, which was Moses.
But the bill will almost certainly be challenged in court, as the U.S. Constitution explicitly prohibits the government from favoring one religion over another. In a statement, a coalition of three civil rights groups criticized the new law, saying it would prevent students from getting an equal education and will make children who have different beliefs feel unsafe at school. Conservative Republicans from states in the so-called Bible Belt have made a number of attempts to bolster public expressions of the Christian faith in recent years. Three other states, Texas, Oklahoma, and Utah, have tried to pass similar measures to display the Ten Commandments in classrooms, but none of them made it into law.
The ancient monument Stonehenge in southern England is often in the news at this time of year because crowds go there to celebrate the summer solstice in the northern hemisphere. This year, as we reported in an earlier podcast, it's been sprayed with an orange substance by climate change activists. The protesters from the pressure group Just Stop Oil insist they use corn flour so it'll wash off in the rain. Nick Merriman is from English Heritage, the organisation that manages Stonehenge. So what did he make of the protests?
We found them deeply saddening. It's a vandalism to one of the world's most celebrated ancient monuments. Stonehenge is about 5,000 years old. What we find difficult to understand is that people in those ancient times were living so sustainably, and the stones are a testament to the desire of people to connect with nature and the earth and the sun and the moon, as well as each other. So it's difficult to understand, and we're deeply saddened about this vandalism. But we've been really touched by the messages of sympathy and support we've had. Our experts have already managed to clean the orange powder from the stones because we were really worried about what would happen if they got in contact with water. But so far, there seems to be no visible damage. The site is open to the public again and for the solstice tomorrow.
Finally, the British musician and screenwriter Ratman has racked up millions of online views and track plays with his socially conscious storytelling and rap. He is a superhero to many of his followers, which is why his new Netflix series, Supercell, about South London superheroes, is so eagerly awaited.
I can move things without touching them.
I don't think you should be using your powers for personal gain.
It's a matter of life and death. If the five of us are together, we can stop this.
You're asking for too much.
Hey, you're not listening to me!
I can't lose you.
Ratman is the creator, director and executive producer. He told us how he came up with the show.
I think first off, I didn't approach it as a superhero show. I more approached it as a show about normal people with superpowers. And right. Someone with superpowers is very different, in my opinion, than actual superheroes putting on a cape. So, I watch a lot of these shows with superheroes, as you say, in there, and I just never understood someone getting superpowers and the first thing they do is get a cape, spandex, and stop a bridge from falling down. So I was thinking, if I got powers, that wouldn't be my first move. So let's start there. And that's what we built from there, really.
You might do something socially useful instead. There's an almost totally black cast, isn't there? Which is something that lots of movies have tried over the years, but it's still pretty rare. Why was that important to you?
I just feel like you don't really see a lot of all blacks or a lot of any ethnic minorities in the sci-fi realm at all on television and film, especially not in the UK. So as soon as I got the opportunity to create a show, I was like, I want to make this show a majority all black cast. And hopefully it opens doors that you can see other races in different genres now.
Your manager is Jay-Z. What was his feedback?
Well, he saw the first two episodes early on, maybe end of last year, and then I bumped into him in February, and he was just like, he loved the twists and turns, he loved the storytelling. He was really supportive, man. It was nice.
Ratman speaking to my colleague Amol Rajan. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition, drop us an email. We love hearing from you. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk or on X, we are at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Tom Bartlett. The producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.